House Human Services will come to order, please. Is Representative... House Human Services, please come to order. Will the Secretary take the roll?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Sheldon Galloway.
Here.
Chair Buckley.
Here.
Representative Regeer.
Excused.
Representative Etchart.
Here.
Representative Hawk.
Here.
Representative Hinkle.
Here.
Representative Nikolakakos.
Excused.
Representative Marshall.
Here.
Representative Smith.
Here.
Representative Welch.
Here.
Representative Staffman.
Here.
Representative Abbott.
Here.
Representative Zephyr.
Here.
Representative Frazier.
Here.
Representative Hall.
Here.
Representative Yakowicz.
Here.
Representative Nickel.
Here.
Representative Rusk.
Here.
Representative Oblander.
Here.
Representative Betry.
Here.
Chair Carlson.
Here.
Oh, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Ms. Reeves. Members, we're going to hear two bills today. We'll start with House Bill 45, and we will hear House Bill 252 second. For everyone who is here to testify, please make sure you signed in the hallway so that we have you on the record. Silence your phones, please, if you will. Sponsors, while you are introducing your bill, you will hear a 5-minute warning, which is your indication to wrap it up in practice for presenting your bill on the floor, where they give you 5 minutes. This is not a hard and fast rule, just mostly for your benefit. We do have a lot of people here to give testimony in person and online, so we will have a 2-minute limit on testimony. When you give testimony, please be sure and spell your name and tell us who you are representing if you are here on behalf of someone else. And don't repeat a lot of testimony that you heard before you. You can just say, I agree with the person in front of me, in the interest of time, so that we can hear as much testimony as possible from as many people as who are in attendance. And with that, Representative, would you like to open on your bill? We will open the hearing on House Bill 45.
Good afternoon, Madam Chairman, members of the committee. This is going to be difficult to pull off in 5 minutes, but I will do the best I can. My name is Bob Keenan, House District 10, and I bring House Bill 45 to you today. It is a hospital community benefit bill. This has been an issue that's been kicking around the legislature for at least 5 years, and it first came to my attention in 2017 when we had a companion bill at the end of the session that included a hospital community benefit assessment for 14 hospitals, and it collected $4.3 million out of the blue at the end of the session, and that went right into the general fund. In December of 17, there was an article in Governing Magazine that I will give to you, but I know better than to pass it out right now and have everybody reading it while I'm trying to get your attention. So I'll keep it for a little bit. But that was a really cool article that was written that explained community benefits and the requirements for nonprofit hospitals to have community benefits. So I will share that. That was my second bite at the apple for awareness. So in the 2021 session, last session, I came up with Senate Bill 383 towards the end of the session that used the same concept that was in that 17 companion bill to raise about $4.5 million for use in the CSCT, the Comprehensive School and Community Treatment issue that was having trouble, and it ended up going from DPHHS to to OPI. Now we're going to put it back this session. But at any rate, in September of 2020, Legislative Audit put out a fantastic audit that concerned itself with charity care and community benefit assessment. That audit was extremely well done. I would encourage you to look at that. It is apparent to me that there will probably be three, maybe four bills that deal with this subject, and I think this committee is going to have your fingerprints on putting that together and coming up with what you see is best to address this issue that was pointed out by Legislative Audit as a glaring need. Statute requires this bill to happen, and I appreciate the fact that the department came to me for a pre-introduced bill to get this ball rolling. This is the audit, and I'll give you a little bit of background that, you know, there are 47 nonprofit hospitals in Montana, and nonprofit is a tax status exempting hospitals from paying local, state, and federal taxes. This is intended to be an acknowledgement of the community benefit provided by nonprofit hospitals. So state law requires DPHHS to ensure large hospitals provide a particular category of community benefit, charity care, which assists qualified patients pay their hospitals. So Montana nonprofit hospitals, and this was in the audit, received more than $146 million in tax exemption benefit. In exchange, hospitals are obligated to benefit their community. Hospitals currently demonstrate that they are meeting this responsibility by self-reporting annual spending on community benefit programs to the Internal Revenue Service. Each hospital individually determines which of their activities qualify. Montana hospitals self-reported more than $257 million in community benefit spending. However, the public has limited information about these activities beyond the total amount of what the hospitals have determined they have spent. The key findings in this report, the audit, was there was a lack of consistent community benefit reporting by hospitals to reduce transparency for policymakers and public. Community benefit spending has no clear impact on the health of Montanans. Department of Public Health and Human Services has not developed a process to ensure hospitals provide charity care. Hence, we are here with this bill, and by the request of the by the department. There was a follow-up audit or a was a follow-up report in June of 22. So the original audit was in September of 20, and then in June of 22, the audit went to the audit committee and pointed out that the department has made no meaningful progress in defining spending or and eligibility obligations for charity care policies for nonprofit hospitals. So the department has stepped up with this bill. They've been working with the hospitals individually and the hospital association as recently as yesterday afternoon. There are probably going to be a lot of proposals, a lot of amendments to this bill. I'm still under 5 minutes. That's great. Is it getting close?
Oh, you're fine, Representative. You talk as much as you
want. So at any rate, the department will more or less walk you through the bill as it is right now, but there is still a lot of negotiations coming, and as I said, there are other bills that are going to probably come in the works that will come into play, and it will be up to this committee. When I walk out of here today, this is your bill to do with as you see fit. The Affordable Care Act mandated that nonprofit hospitals provide the charity care as part of their nonprofit tax exempt status. So let's see, I can probably wind it up. There are statutes now that are in play. It currently grants the department broad authority to require reports from healthcare facilities. But the agency does not wish to abuse the authority and use the authority to add unnecessary red tape. I'll leave it at that. And we'll see how we do with proponents, opponents, informational witnesses. Thank you, Madam Chairman.
Thank you, Representative. We will go ahead and hear from proponents in the room.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Brenton Craigs, spelled B-R-E-N-T-O-N-C-R-A-G-G-S. I'm the Information Regulatory Affairs Coordinator for the Department of Public Health and Human Services. I'd like to thank Representative Keenan for his sponsorship of House Bill 45. Madam Chair, members of the committee, with your permission, we would like to hand out a couple of documents, if that is acceptable.
That is just fine. They can go to the secretary, please.
These two documents that we are handing out is a copy of the Community Benefit and Charity Care Obligations Legislative Audit Report from 2020, as well as a template for our 2022 Hospital and Critical Access Hospital Annual Report. HB 45 has been developed in response to the Legislative Audit Division findings from LAD's September 2020 report. The report recommended the legislature enact law defining expectations regarding detailed reporting of community benefit spending and its impact on community health, and the state government entity responsible for actively reviewing community benefit spending. DPHHS, as Representative Keenan mentioned, currently may utilize MCA 50-5-106 to dictate what information must be reported to satisfy the findings of these reports. But instead, we have chosen to work with both the legislature and our stakeholders alike in good faith to undergo a rulemaking process dictated by this bill, in which stakeholders will have transparent input and feedback regarding both what information must be reported to develop these standards and what the standards themselves will eventually entail. We've had some feedback on the bill requesting that we limit our authority in MCA 50-5-106 more than we already are to instead collect only IRS submitted documents, specifically 990s, Schedule H's, and community health needs assessment reports, which collectively only provide high level information and do not delve far enough into detail to develop the effective standards. The department has already collected information not contained in these IRS submitted reports, an example of which being this hospital and critical access hospital annual report also being passed around. Instead of simply dictating what must be provided, the department has instead invited stakeholders to participate in a process that provides accountability and feedback to avoid unnecessary red tape, especially when determining rules for compliance for critical access in rural hospitals versus large city hospitals. As a sign of this commitment to transparency and cooperation as well, we are already writing an amendment changing the submission date that's currently in statute of April 15 for reports to instead change it to within 30 days of when hospitals have to submit their IRS filings to ease administrative burden. We also have in the bill a promise to try do our best to stick to already collected data by these hospitals to reduce burden. A primary goal of Medicaid expansion was to provide low-income families with access to health care services that result in improved health outcomes. To accomplish this, the data needs to be accurate, comparable, consistent, and yet flexible enough to not overly burden rural healthcare facilities. We believe this bill will provide such data, will allow for a collaborative rulemaking process, which will satisfy the recommendations of the audit report, and we urge the committee to pass House Bill 45. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Craigs. I've never seen such perfect timing for a three-minute comment. We will go ahead and hear from any further proponents in the room. Are there any opponents in the room?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Dwayne Pressinger, spelled D-U-A-N-E-P-R-E-S-H-I-N-G-E-R. I'm representing the Montana Hospital Association, and if it's okay with the chair, I have some handouts.
Yes, to the secretary, please.
Thank you. The Montana Hospital Association would like to thank Representative Keenan and the department for bringing a bill forward. MHA respectfully opposes House Bill 45, but does have some amendment language that would improve the bill while also reducing the additional administrative burden this bill places on Montana hospitals. We do appreciate the intent of House Bill 45 and have worked closely with the department and the and the sponsor to address our concerns, but at this point have been unable to come to an agreement. We are committed to being transparent and providing the information necessary to the department outlining the benefits provided in the local community. Just one of the handouts is, it's supposed to be red, it printed blue. My wife's an English teacher, so she doesn't use red, so apparently blue is better anyways. So that has our proposed amendments in it. I know it's not handed out, but in section one, our proposed amendment is to be able to submit Schedule H of the IRS 990 report. We believe that has all the information necessary in it. We also change the language to only impact those facilities under IRS code 501c3, which exempts county hospitals and also the state Warm Springs from complying with this requirement. And we also, so we believe that Schedule H has all the information. In Schedules 2, we have no changes whatsoever. In 3, our language makes proposed changes that would align the department that they have to comply with federal criteria. As I discussed weeks ago when we provide a high-level overview of hospitals, hospitals are very highly regulated, and one of those regulatory is the IRS code 501c3 that outlines what the community benefit is. We believe the language is duplicative of federal regulations already, as hospitals already have a written charity policy and a community health benefit.
1 minute.
There's no changes in Section 4 and 5. The other issue in Section 3 is we believe it gives very wide overview to the department with no oversight from the legislative body. In closing, we propose the changes would provide the department full access to all the information. In addition, one of the changes that Mr. Craigs had spoken about was the timing of the reports. By following that timing, he's able to get more than 1 year worth of data prior to the schedule of rules, and so he could get multiple years back so they could have a more complete data set. And we also want to add that because of the 2020 legislative audit, we did create a program within the Montana Hospital Association that worked with all of our hospitals to provide education on the reporting of community benefits so it's consistent across all of our different facilities. And we do want to stress that we will continue to work with the department and the sponsor in regards to amendments to the bill. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Breschinger. Are there any further opponents in the room? Are there any informational witnesses in the room?
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Leslie Howe, L-E-S-L-I-E-H-O-W-E. I work for the Department of Public Health and Human Services, Office of the Inspector General, and my job title is Certificate of Need Program Manager, and I'm here for informational purposes.
Thank you. Are there any further informational witnesses in the room?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Sarah Carlson. I work for the Legislative Audit Division, and I was the lead staff person conducting this audit. My job title used to be performance auditor, but now we are management and program analyst. That's more of a state of art term. So, and it's more descriptive also. We go in and look at policies and procedures, and if things are lining up with, you know, if things are in compliance and what could be done to be more effective and efficient. So that's our, that's what performance audit or management and program analysts do down at Legislative Audit. If you want more information about what Legislative Audit is all about, the sponsor was on Legislative Audit for a long time, as was Representative Abbott. So you can ask them for more on Legislative Audit Division. So what I'd like to do is just tell you that...
Pardon me, Ms. Carlson.
Yes.
Informational witness can introduce themselves and then be available for questions from the committee.
Oh, I was just going to ask if I could hand out the... I'd like to do is... No, I wasn't going to...
Oh.
Maybe it sounded like I was ramping up to that, but no, I just want to... if with your permission, I would just like to hand out a summary copy of the survey.
Okay.
Or of the report, and that my contact information is on there also. If anybody wants a link to where the full report is or a hard copy, whatever it might be, I can help you out with that.
Certainly. Thank you. That's very helpful. That can go to the secretary, too.
Thank you. I'll be around available for questions.
I apologize for interrupting you. Are there any further informational witnesses in the room? And seeing none, we will go ahead and take questions from the committee. We'll start with Representative Yakowich.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee. I'd like to talk to the sponsor, Madam Chair.
Representative Keenan.
Madam Chair, Representative Yakowich.
Madam Chair, Representative Keenan, I have a question that I was hearing expectations, rulemaking, data, auditing, and so my question to you, Representative, is the why. Why are we doing this? If you could give me an example or a concern.
State law requires this be done, and the department is following state law that this be accomplished. It's also part of federal rules, regulations. It's part of the nonprofit status.
All right. Follow up.
Follow up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Because I'm new to this process, my question would be, there's no concerns. We're just doing this as a natural process of policy.
I think, Madam Chair, Representative, I think we're doing it. It's expected that nonprofit entities justify the tax breaks that they get by providing evidence that they have community benefit for their nonprofit status.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative.
Representative Staffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Question for the sponsor. Madam Chair, Representative, thank you very much for the bill. Could you comment on the Hospital Association's amendments that they've proposed and whether you support them or not, and if so, why not?
Madam Chair, Representative, I cannot go into the details of them. I saw them last night. As I said, they're still negotiating back and forth with the department. But the details of those, express any opinion on. I'm carrying the bill and hoping that everything will work out between the department and the Hospital Association so that what needs to be accomplished is accomplished.
Thank you. Madam Chair, may I have a question of Mr. Pressinger?
Certainly. Mr. Pressinger.
Staffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Pressinger, I have a couple of questions about definitions. And so when the bill refers to a hospital, there's the first two definitions, really. Does that include like a hospital-based practice? For example, if the hospital owns a primary care practice as part of it, and when the hospital files these forms with their information, is that included, or is it simply the hospital, what we think of classically as a hospital?
Representative Staffman, it's all of the. It's your first answer. It's all those things are included in that.
Okay, and one more follow-up, Madam Chair.
Follow-up.
Definition again. When we talk about community benefits, we now have hospitals like the Billings Clinic, just for example, that is based in Billings but now has a branch in Bozeman and other places as well, and Bozeman Health has a branch in other places. What is the community? How did we define the community when they report community benefits when they may be statewide or multiple communities? Thank you.
Madam Chair, Representative Staffman, for my information, the Billings Clinic, as an example, would be responsible to do one community health benefit document that would cover all of their different areas. And so it would be included if they're in, because Billings Clinic is in more areas than just Billings, right? You spoke Bozeman, but also in other communities with some of their other facilities. So it encompasses all of their different areas, and they would have things that they would do in all those communities that would be rolled up and be included in that Schedule H. And also, just to add on, the Schedule H is one of the handouts that I provided that has a cover sheet that kind of outlines all the different sections and what information is required to be put in those sections as part of the community health benefit.
Madam Chair, may I get just one last very quick clarification?
Follow up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And so when Billings Clinic, for example, lists the community benefits on this Schedule H. Does it list it separately for its various communities, or is it all lumped into one?
Madam Chair, Representative Stefan, I don't know the answer to that, but let me turn around and look at someone. Is it okay if I defer that to Mr. Olson?
Representative Stefan, would you like to refer your question?
Thank you, Madam Chair, yes.
Thank you.
Oh, I apologize. I'm not sure who this witness is. He did not testify today.
I did not. Madam Chair, as long as he gives his name and organization for the record, he can be re-referred to.
Okay, that sounds fine. Just if you would spell your name for the record and introduce yourself, please.
Do that. Madam Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Bob Olson. I'm the interim president and CEO from the Hospital Association, so I'm with Mr. Pressinger.
Mr. Olson, would you consider yourself on the proponent or opponent list?
Well, the association is in opposition of the bill. We just didn't want to have numerous employees walk up and give the same opposition.
Okay, so opponent. Okay, for the record, thank you.
Thank you. So, Representative Staffman, Madam Chairman, Representative Staffman, the question being, how does a hospital report the multiple locations that it serves and roll up the data from the various local communities into a single report? There is a schedule in the Schedule H that delineates all of the various locations they offer services. So if they have multiple hospitals, clinics, other health facilities, ambulatory surgery centers, they're all delineated which ones are in the report and where they're located on that form.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Minority Leader Abbott.
Thank you, Madam Chair, for Mr. Craigs. Madam Chair, Mr. Craigs, there's a lot of information included in the 990 Schedule H. Are you looking for specific information that's not included in Schedule H?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, that's what the rulemaking process is for. So the first step of what we are envisioning is before we even start setting these standards for community benefits, we wish to have a conversation. We used to go through a rulemaking process during which the stakeholders, including the hospitals and the hospital association, will be a part of that conversation from the beginning, both at the conceptual phase as well as when the public comment phase comes around, so that everyone's able to show their concerns, we're able to have conversations about it, we're able to work together to make sure that as much as possible, which I believe it's Section 4A or 4B, I don't have the bill in front of me. As much as possible, we are limiting what is being asked for to information that the hospitals already collect. But we at the same time also do not wish to restrict ourselves to that in case the need arises. As the legislative audit report shows, currently we do not have sufficient standards in order to establish these community benefits. I mean, we do not have sufficient collection of data. We do not have sufficient standards for these community benefits. And so we may need to collect additional pieces of data. There are examples that we've looked at that may have to look at. One of the issues with Schedule H, for example, as in 90s, is that it looks at more of a high-level overview, a high-level, more of an aggregate spending amount, but it does not go into as much details. We may want to look at more in-depth details of cost-to-charge ratios and what are considered in the IRS reports. We may look at what constitutes community building. There's different things that are contained in that just provide very high-level overviews that are not fully elaborated on. And as far as the IRS reports goes, basically they don't really look too much into detail as to what actually characterizes community benefits. The IRS doesn't look at if the community benefit spending is being reflected in a measurable benefit to the community. We need to have these conversations to determine what can be collected without imposing an undue burden on the hospitals, on the healthcare facilities, in order to basically come to a determination of what information needs to be collected, how to collect the information, and from there establish the standards.
Madam Chair, follow up.
Follow up.
Madam Chair, Mr. Craigs, so that's a lot of rulemaking authority without much oversight from the legislature.
Well, as we said, we do hope that the legislature will be involved in that. But if you look at the actual current text of MCA 50-5-106, we can basically, as it currently stands, the department can actually request almost, there's very few restrictions on what the information we can require. What we're trying to lay out in here is an actual set out process by which we will undergo rulemaking and with specific goals in mind, but also laying out that there will be cooperation, there will be collaboration, and that there is going to be oversight and work with the legislature in this process.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A follow-up for Ms. Carlson, please.
Ms. Carlson.
Madam Chair, Ms. Carlson, nice to see you. I just left the audit committee. I don't know if you heard.
No, I'm Madam Chair, Representative, I'm aware of that. You were there a while.
Yeah, that's true. Madam Chair, Ms. Carlson, if you sort of think back to the hearing on this audit, we had a robust conversation. I had some concerns about the way that the audit division decided to define community benefit. Did you hire an outside expert in public health to design the scope of this audit?
Madam Chair, Representative Addit, I do recall we talked about this, and no, we didn't. It was a look. What we did in this work is that we wanted to have something to show the committee of sort of examples of what we were talking about. And the data we got, I think it was from the Pew Center. So we used some, you know, solid data about obesity and over drinking, and I don't remember all the details, but we knew this, the data was good, and we sort of compared that to the community benefit priorities that had been identified, and we couldn't find any real connection between those. But we also acknowledged in the report that, you know, this was just what it was. It was an example of one way you could do it, but we weren't saying that was the only way. It was just a sort of an illustration of there's all kinds of data out there. You know, there should at some place be a way to measure the effects of community benefit spending.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Ms. Carlson. I would take a hard copy of the full report again, just to refresh my memory. Thank you. Madam Vice Chair, one for Mr. Preschner.
Yes. We'll redirect to Mr. Preschner.
Madam Vice Chair, Representative Abbott.
Madam Vice Chair, Mr. Preschner, can you talk to us a little bit about how community benefit could vary from community to community and what that variability does to this kind of burdensome reporting?
Yeah. Thank you, Vice Chair and Representative Abbott. So as part of being a nonprofit hospital, each hospital has to work on a community health needs assessment, which is a 3-year kind of overview document, and that is included in that is some of the community benefit. And as Ms. Carlson stated, you know, some of their findings were that, you know, that people were still drinking, and I mean the community needs assessment is more than just the hospital, right? It's the needs of the entire community, and a lot of it's outside the scope of what a hospital can control. It includes, you know, behavioral health providers. It could be public health, food insecurity, all those kind of things. And I'd also say, you know, what the needs of Bozeman are different than the needs of Cut Bank. And so it's not a one-size-fits-all that the community benefit in Bozeman is different than, and so each of those communities are unique, and so the IRS regulations allow each of those different community benefits to be unique based on the needs of the community.
Are there any further questions from the committee? Representative Etchert.
Okay, so I'm not sure who this question will be to, Mrs. Chair. So can I ask it and then you can decide?
Well, unless you want to take a guess, we can always re-refer the question if maybe the sponsor would be able to help you decide who would be best to answer that question, Representative Etchert.
I can refer in a heartbeat. Defer.
Madam Chair, Representative Keenan, I would like to see copies of the 990H and the 900H from several hospitals across Montana, and I don't want to spend the time to look them up myself. Can someone do that and provide them to the committee? I'm being honest.
Excuse me, Madam Chair. Representative, I think Mr. Preschner could probably handle that. I understand.
Mr. Preschner.
Madam Chair, Representative Etchert, we'd be happy to provide some copies electronically, or should we kill some more trees?
I think electronically may be more useful if that can go to the committee and it can be sent out to all members. Thank you.
Thank you.
Do you have a follow-up? Representative Marshall.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For Mr. Griggs? I'm going to feel like an attorney buried in paperwork over here.
Representative Marshall.
Thank you. Madam Chair, Mr. Griggs, is I'm saying that correctly?
Madam Chair, Mr. Representative Marshall, yes, you are.
Okay, so you're talking about setting up these rules, these guidelines. I'm looking at this sample amendment that was passed out. I actually like it because of the tax implications and the dates. Being a business owner, it didn't really make sense on its face, but now it does. But what I am worried about, being a former federal person, you're using the federal guidelines now for this, or is that correct?
Madam Chair and members of the committee, I would actually like to defer this question to Leslie Howe, if you wouldn't mind.
Yep.
Madam Chair, Representative.
Madam Chair, Ms. Howe, we're doing these reports right now. According to this, we're going to do these reports are going to be done under the federal guidelines until the rules are made up and adopted, figured out. Is that correct?
That's how it's written. My expertise is in the current information that we gather, and that is not based on federal guidelines. It's what the state wants, if that makes sense.
Okay, follow up. Thank you. Follow up. Madam Chair, Ms. Howe, so what I'm getting at is it says in here that we're going to use the reports are going to be done according to the federal guidelines until we get it done. I'm just worried, I know how federal regulations work, and usually when you go below federal, you can add to but not take away. How much are we going to add on to this?
That would be covered in the rulemaking. We just needed something until the rulemaking was completed, so we defaulted to the federal guidelines.
Okay. That's why I wanted him first. Anyway, thank you.
Are there any further questions? Representative Nickel, and then Representative Howe.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is for Mr. Pressinger.
Madam Chair, Representative Nickel.
Madam Chair, Mr. Pressinger. I just have two quick questions. One, how much info is actually available to the public? I'm just wondering from privacy standpoint, how much you're actually having to give up to the public. And then also, is there community input since this is for the community?
Madam Chair, Representative Nickel, so right now all this information is posted online. The IRS 990 Schedule H is all posted online. And in addition, the community health benefit, that process is a public process where they bring the community together to meet and have input in regards to that plan, and it's updated every 3 years.
Excellent. Thank you.
Representative Howell.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Also for Mr. Pressinger, sorry, I could have been faster with that.
Madam Chair, Representative Howell.
Madam Chair, Mr. Pressinger, I want to just follow up a little bit, I think, on what a couple other questions have been pointing to. I think there's maybe a outdated assumption with some of this that charity care and community benefit policies are mostly about providing services to uninsured or underinsured patients. And I think part of this is about how much money is spent to provide that care. My question is if you could just line out give us some examples of what other community benefits hospitals provide. I'm concerned about an attempt to define and establish something that sounds like could vary wildly from hospital to hospital and community to community. So I'm just wondering if you can come all the way down to grass level and give us some examples of that.
Representative House, so high level examples would be, you know, it could be in local communities, community gardens could be considered, you know, providing some behavioral health outreach, some educational opportunities in the communities, you know, would be considered as community benefit. And again, as I spoke earlier, you know, each community is different. And so what the needs of one, you know, in some communities, it might be more to offset the cost of providing care at below cost. But in other communities, it would be much broader than that.
Follow up. Thank you. That's helpful. And could you ballpark for me the general percentage of charity care versus community benefits per hospital? Does it work that way?
Madam Chair, Representative Howell, I can't. Let me turn around and look and see if Mr. Olson can. He's been around much, much longer than I have.
Thank you. Okay to re-refer, Madam Chair?
Of course.
Thank you.
What'd you think of that introduction? Madam Chair, Representative Howe, I'll give you a few examples of the wide variety of community benefits. Here in Helena, if you go to any sporting event, you'll see a St. Peter's Hospital ambulance standing by. That's a community benefit. If you go out to the C.R. Anderson Middle School, you'll see equipment on the playground that was supplied by St. Peter's Health years ago for the kids to have a playground, so that they had those things. If you go to Missoula, you'll find a place where St. Patrick's Hospital employees took paid time to go work on rebuilding a community park that they went in. Those are in community engagement activities that you'll see delineated in that Schedule H. Other things that you'll see is subsidizing services that don't pay for themselves. Emergency rooms notoriously don't pay for themselves. The subsidy to make sure there's an emergency room where no for-profit would ever put one is a community benefit. People deliver inpatient psychiatric services. They put facilities. If you look at it, you know, there are hospitals in Montana. Their existence is a community benefit because no for-profit will put a hospital in some of those communities. So you'll see in that delineation in Schedule H, which is the universe of what the Internal Revenue Service requires, those reports won't go away with this state initiative, but you'll see the delineation, community building, health improvement, pushing for health status. When you see a local hospital advertising to encourage people to engage in healthy lifestyles, that is a community benefit. Those are things that are not delivering services to patients, but are good for promoting health, wellness, community health. Those are all community benefits they're engaged in.
Thank you.
Vice Chair Sheldon Galloway.
Mr. Olson, while he was still up there, please. Madam Chair.
Thank you,
Madam Chair. I have two questions. At our airport in Great Falls, benefits is highly advertised, like as you walk up the stairs and all over the place. Is that part of this community benefit package for the hospital?
Madam Chairman, Vice Chairman Sheldon Galloway, no. Advertising is not a community benefit. That's a business practice to just make services available.
Okay, and then one more follow-up, please. Thank you, Madam Chair. When a hospital builds a new building in a community, it becomes an asset back to the hospital. Is that a community benefit?
Madam Chairman, Representative Galloway, there have been examples of hospitals putting buildings in communities that would otherwise not have those. If they are subsidized and operate at a loss, the loss could be construed to be a community benefit. That's been one of those areas where you put it there and you show that it's to benefit a community that's underserved. So if you locate a clinic, for example, in an inner city area where they're in a healthcare desert, it could be a community benefit.
So, Madam Chair, clarity question? Follow-up? Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for my indulgence here, Mr. Olson and
Glad
Chairman.
To do it.
So does the expense of building the building deduct off of your profit of the year and make you down to that nonprofit status, I guess is my real question.
Madam Chair, Vice Chair Sheldon Galloway, no. The capital investment would go on the books of a hospital as an asset. The operating subsidies might find their way onto those reports, but not the capital investment.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Mr. Olson. Buttrey.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Olson, don't go anywhere, please. Madam Chair, a couple questions for Mr. Olson.
Let's be kind to the old guy. Come on.
Representative Buttrey.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, Mr. Olson, we had heard some testimony by the department, I think in response to a question that somebody had asked, what else are they looking for? And it sounded like there wasn't really an answer. So my mind starts thinking about unfettered rulemaking and department authority, and that scares me to death. So I'm hoping you've got a little further with this. Has the MHA or the hospitals approached the department and said, hey, look, we report this data now to the feds. We have all this. What else do you need? Have you requested that of the department?
Madam Chairman, Representative Buttrey, yes, we've had those conversations with the department. The problem with Section 1 of this bill is it says we'll have our own report, we'll have our own reporting deadlines, we'll make up a report, and we'll require you to fill it out. The reports that are in the public today are audited. The hospitals all do them. Hospitals are on fiscal years. So a June fiscal year won't have a report for that date. Our message is that by doing a whole new set of reporting means now we have to make a whole new set of reporting. At the end of the day, what we're looking for is those reports, the universe of what's there can be accumulated, it can be measured, and from that, we feel that would inform the department's rulemaking, but it also would give them an idea of we've evaluated the data, we have questions, we want something more. You come back, and then we could find out what more there is to provide.
Just a few more follow-ups, please.
Follow-up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, Mr. Olson, so back to the end of my question, you requested that from the department. Have you gotten a response from the department as to what else they want that's not already collected?
Madam Chairman, Representative Buttrey, no, the department hasn't identified any particular thing. They've figured there might be time where they could think of things that aren't on those reports they'd like to see.
Okay, follow-up.
Follow-up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, Mr. Olson, the community benefit, as you testified, is something that's generated within the local community. The community meets and decides what their needs are and then how the hospitals provide towards those needs qualifies as community benefit. If the department then comes up with requirements that are outside of what the community has identified as needs, and you have to do additional work, or they decide that what the community has identified is not important and does not qualify as community benefit, I guess, first of all, if you have to do additional work, how do you absorb that cost? How are the hospitals? And if you have things that you do in a local community, but the state says this doesn't apply, what could be the repercussions and how would you adjust for that?
Madam Chairman, Representative Buttrey, we thought a lot about this and we've had at least some conversations with our members about this. Right now, every community through their board, their local community, figures out how much charity care they'll give, what levels of charity they'll allow. They'll figure out how they're going to do other kinds of community investments. They'll figure out how they're going to put services into the community that they might otherwise not afford. That's all local. The state adopts rules, and I've said to them, give you the wisdom of Solomon, because now you have an administrative rule that says here's what you have to do, here's the amounts you have to give in order to justify your tax status. And remember, now we're not measuring that against tax obligation. We're just saying these are what you have to do to merit compliance with the rules. And if you don't, you pay fines. to be named later. So that's kind of where we're at today, to which we would say, you just took it off the backs of the local communities and put it back on the Department of Public Health. So now it becomes your obligation to determine. Now, if you're out of sync with what a hospital can do, yeah, it might affect on what you can do. If you say there has to be more charity care, maybe you do less in subsidized services. If you do more in subsidized services, maybe you can't afford the charity care. If you do both and it becomes unaffordable, it just gets passed on to the patients as higher costs.
And last follow-up, Madam Chair.
Follow-up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Olson, so do hospitals pay any taxes?
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Buttrey, hospitals pay a lot of taxes. The tax-exempt status is you don't pay is on your buildings and equipment that are used for providing care. So if you have buildings that you own or that you rent or that you have been given from donations, things like that, they're all taxable. And hospitals actually pay millions of dollars of taxes. The hospitals also pay a tax to help support the Medicaid program. So they contribute taxes in that way too. So you're not exempt from all property taxes, and you're not exempt from all income taxes. If you do business that's not related, unrelated to the delivery of healthcare services, that's called unrelated business income taxes, you pay those taxes too. So there are a number of taxes we pay.
Mr. Olson, I have a follow-up for you, and then we'll go, no? I just want to go back to the very last thing you said. So if I understand you, what you just said is hospitals pay a lot of property tax on their buildings, and they pay what was the second thing? But the Medicaid. And when you say that you pay the Medicaid tax, are you referring to the bed tax? Okay, could you just briefly talk about the hospital utilization fee, if that's what you mean by the Medicaid tax?
Right, yes, Madam Chairman. So the property tax question, and I use this as an example, one of the best examples. We've been through at least three interim discussions with the Economic Affairs Interim Council, where they looked extensively at this, and all the hospitals had to produce all of the properties they own and show which ones are taxable, which ones are not. The Department of Revenue created a database, and we all go through delineating all that property, reporting it to the Department of Revenue, and then we redo that report every few years to make sure it's robust. So there's a robust database of properties that are taxable but are owned by hospitals that are nonprofits. So there's that. The hospital tax itself is a tax levied on the hospitals to supply the match necessary for the state to fund part of the Medicaid program. Some of that is returned to the hospitals in payments to supplement their routine rates. Some of those payments are made to the state to help fund expansion services that go to all providers, not just hospitals. But that tax is paid on an annual basis and helps fund the state government.
Thank you. Vice Chair Buckley, did you have your question answered? Okay. Were there further questions, Representative Yakowich and then Representative Smith?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I know it's we received a lot of information. I wanted to talk to Mrs. Carlson. And I just beg the pardon of our committee here with all the material we got. But I went through the packet you gave us. And we received from you,
yes,
which is a summary of this here.
Yes.
And what intrigues me, and maybe I'm not catching everything here, but on 20, 22, 24, 26, and 28, it continues to say it is not clear if community benefit spending is improving mental health. It is not clear benefit spending is improving access to health care. It is not clear the community benefit is spending to improve Montana's ability to make health lifestyle choices. So I'm just wondering, how do you are we doing this audit in order to clarify this? And it is certainly, being in Billings, Madam Chair, I found that hospitals are very accommodating. They've done a lot for us. Mansfield Center, St. Vincent Hospital, and all that. So I see that in Billings, but could you just in a nutshell, why it seems a little bit critical to me, and maybe I'm not reading this right, but I'm just, and could you just tie that into what we're doing here?
Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And
Madam Chair, Representative, this is a little bit the same as what Representative Abbott, who was on the committee, and we talked at length during the audit committee also, that, and it's, I think, clear in the report that we were using those statistics and that information as an example of a way you can talk about benefit to the community in a, you know, with numbers and a return on investment or whatever terminology you want to use. And we were not going to be satisfied with saying, well, they should do something in this area without providing an example. But we were clear that, you know, as Dwayne or Mr. Pressinger said, you know, there's lots of things that go into obesity. There's lots of things that go into other health concerns in a community. But the point we were making is that the system somehow, somewhere, you should be able to tie what the community benefit is to what's happening in the community, what's actually the result. And then to kind of tie it back to what we were you all were talking about with the information, I think you want to keep in mind that the feds do require the information, and as I recall, it's been a while since I looked at them, the 990s and the Schedule H's do have a fair amount of information that would be helpful, but the problem is, what we found in our work was that no one's looking at it. The IRS isn't looking at it particularly. The department, there is statute that says the department should be looking at charity care. Not that there's any requirements or anything, but just to see if they're providing charity care. And that's what the issue is. The information, I think, is there. I know that the department's going to check for, you know, other input, but I don't think there's much beyond the Schedule H's and I-90s, but you need to have effective review and oversight. You need to have somebody looking at them and saying, this is an interesting expenditure on this particular activity. That was the issue, I guess. Not the information, but having someone to review it.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair and Ms. Carlson.
Okay. Representative Smith.
I have a question for Mr. Craggs.
Madam Chair, Representative Smith.
So I was looking at page 3, line 21. So it's no later than July 1st, 2024, the department shall adopt rules to implement the charity care and community benefit requirements, including but not limited to rules to, and then I skip down to D, establish penalties for failing to comply with 55106, which is the reporting that we're talking about, and this section. And then this is the sentence that I guess my question is about. The penalties may be in addition to penalties provided for in 55.112. So I went and looked at it. So those are civil penalties, $1,000 for each day in violation that mostly applies, I think, to confidential, like PII health information, I think, based on skimming that statute. And I guess I always hesitate. I guess I'll say this, and this is sort of my question. So typically see criminal penalties in statute, and then you see penalties, the $1,000 for each day in violation in statute. And so I guess I'm wondering, it looks like the way this is written, there's rulemaking authority for the department to choose what penalty in addition to existing hospital penalties are already in the code. Do you have a sense of what the department is thinking for the penalties in that rule?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Representative Smith, no, we do not currently. What we were looking at in regard to that rule is, as far as community benefits go, we need to collect more information. We need to look at this data for especially larger hospitals. It may wind up being a situation where there were a community benefit that they need to be providing based on their tax status and other factors may exceed the maximum amount of that fine. So let's say that fine is $1,000 a day. There's 365 days a year. based on the tax benefits that they receive, they may need to provide a community benefit that is greater than that amount. And what we would try to avoid is going through a rulemaking process to have these conversations, to look at these standards. Obviously, developing different standards for smaller acute care hospitals, rural emergency hospitals, smaller hospitals in more rural parts of Montana compared to the larger big 12, 14 hospitals, and looking at those, setting those standards, so then the smaller hospitals, that $1,000 may be extremely painful, and they may need to comply with something less and if they're out of compliance. Larger hospitals may need to have something more. So that but as far as what those exact standards are, no, we do not have that, and that is part of the purpose of the rulemaking process, which is where we would like to have these conversations. We'd like to seek these input and have this back and forth in an open and transparent way to establish these standards. As the statute currently stands, we could simply dictate this, but again, we'd rather not. This bill is actually the department bringing a bill to limit ourselves and our ability to do this.
Follow up. So just quick follow up. So I guess what I'm struggling with is, it sounds like, so the department has pretty substantial flexibility based on this language to adopt rules. And so do you envision the penalties being articulated in the rules, like $1,000, $2,000, $3,000, $100,000, whatever it would be? Or do you see a group deciding on an individual basis what the penalties would be?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Representative Smith, again, that is something that is going to be the result of our conversations with our stakeholders, with the legislature, and through this rulemaking process at the conceptual phase, at the public comment phase, throughout the entire process.
We have time for one short question. Representative Staffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Question from Mr. Craigs.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Representative Staffman.
Madam Chair, Mr. Craigs, I asked this question to the sponsor, but I probably should have referred it to you at this time. Could you comment on the Hospital Association's proposed amendments, and what's the problem with them in your mind, if there is indeed a problem?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Representative Staffman, we did meet with the Hospital Association on the amendments. Most of the amendments were not, most of the later amendments in particular were not as material. The primary two main amendments that they were concerned with from our conversations was the filing date, which we are already working on an amendment of. We've agreed, we've understood the concerns. And the initial language that we were looking at was in January. We initially moved it back due to feedback that we had received, but due to the different filing dates for different hospitals, we've decided to go with this flexibility, and what we're the amendment language, which is still being worked on right now, but will be more tied to the IRS filing dates for the individual hospitals. So it'll be much more flexible. As for the proposed amendment language, the amendment language that is being proposed would actually further change the current statute 50-5-106 and limit the authority as it currently stands in that statute to a much larger degree than what our bill is already doing. This would also impact, say, for example, the report that I handed out earlier as a template, the 2022 Hospital and Critical Access Hospital Annual Report. Under these proposed amendments, we wouldn't be able to collect that. We would only be able to collect the 990s, the Schedule H's, and the CHINAs, the CHNAs, which are reported every 3 years. We need more flexibilities, because as the Legislative Audit Report highlighted, and let me make sure I get this right, community benefit spending in Montana currently has no clear impact on the general health of Montanans, and there's no generally accepted guidance on specific activities hospitals should consider to be community benefits. This lack of consistent valuation determinations makes analysis difficult, which reduces transparency for policymakers and for the public. What we have provided examples of additional pieces of information that we may be looking at, but we don't want to commit to these additional pieces of information because, truth be told, we may not wind up collecting them. We don't want to scare away the hospitals. We don't want to scare away the hospital association. We'd rather bring them to the table and have these conversations. But there are issues. The Schedule H's do not provide all the information that is needed. Neither do the CHNAs or the 990s. There is a lot of it is high-level overview without going into the details of what is being done, nor does it look at the outcomes or the results. And that is what's something that we are concerned with. Above all else, we want transparency and we want accountability, and that goes for us as well as our stakeholders and who we are working with on these rules.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
That was quite short for two attorneys. Okay. I would like to invite the sponsor to come up and close on his bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee. I definitely appreciate this hearing today, and I really think that both all parties can work this out. My own personal interest, all of our interest, is for perhaps a community benefit for good community mental health crisis response, psych evaluations at warming centers or homeless. Those are the kinds of things that I'm looking for a community benefit, rather than what we have now, and we have no idea what we have. But with that, thank you very much, Madam Chair. I will leave this article from Governing Magazine with the Secretary for you to peruse. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative Keenan. Members, we'll just take a... Oh, I was going to say we'd take a short break, but I see the sponsors here, so we will close the hearing on House Bill 45. And open the hearing on House Bill 252. Now, Representative, you may go ahead and open on your bill. You weren't here for the benefit of my pre-introduction speech, but what we're going to do is there will be a timer at 5 minutes. So if you're not done at that time, you can know to wrap it up, and we'll leave. You have plenty of people here as proponents, so go ahead and open on your bill, Representative Carlin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Jonathan Carlin, K-A-R-L-E-N, representing Western Missoula, Frenchtown, and Huson. For the chance to present to you today House Bill 252 for your consideration. And I will keep my opening remarks really brief and say that I am really honored to bring this bill because I truly believe this bill will save the lives of young Montanans. It's going to empower parents and families to make the best decisions for their children, and it's going to provide much needed resources and help for schools and school districts across our state, rural and urban. And to put this bill into some context into why I believe it is the need for this is so urgent. Suicide is the second leading cause of death among young adults in the United States, but the problem that this bill is trying to solve is that in Montana, youth commit suicide at a rate more than 2.6 times the national rate. Montana kids have more than double the suicide rate compared with the rest of the country, and I think it is fair to say that we all find that unacceptable and want to do whatever we can to fix this problem. And of course, the impacts of youth suicide are far-reaching and devastating. And so what this bill does is it takes a program that has data behind it, that's working, that's successful, and we make sure and we essentially pour fuel on the fire. And what that program is mental health screening in schools. It's called the Screening Linked to Care Program. And the bill briefly describes this program in Section 1, where the proponents will speak in more depth to this, is that students in Montana schools, everything is with consent of families and school leadership, are screened, and then the students that are in most risk of being in crisis are connected with mental health professionals. And before I turn it over, I want to highlight on page 1, line 21, part of what this bill does, and in my opinion, the most valuable part of this bill, is that we establish a network of mental health professionals who commit to being available to provide continued clinical care to students who have an identified need for mental health services. So we're identifying the kids that are most at risk of suicide and severe mental health problems, and we're connecting them with a network of therapists, often within a day. And the data shows, as others will elaborate on, that this program is working, and what we need to do is make this program, this mental health screening program, we need to make it statewide, and we need reliable funding to continue to grow the network of mental health professionals and make sure that every kid in our state is able to get the help that they need when they need it. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee.
Thank you, Representative. If you were here at the beginning of the hearing, you heard that we are going to have a two-minute time limit. I know it's shorter than typical, but we have at least 18 people who I know of who are planning to testify. So if you can keep your remarks as brief as possible and maybe just say, I agree with someone, instead of repeating their remarks. If you have written testimony, you can just hand that in and the secretary will make it available to the committee. Remember to state your name for the record, and we will hear from proponents in the room.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, State Superintendent Elsie Arntzen, A-R-N-T-Z-E-N. I'm very humbled to be a proponent for this bill. There are many solutions that I know that can be attributed for helping and aiding, not just in general health for our Montana children, but also for mental health. One of the things that I would ask, and I know the sponsor is looking at this as well, is we need to make sure that there is student data privacy in any manner, shape, or form when there might be an exchange either from a school or from our agency to another agency. And I know that the representative is being so kind, and we're looking forward to seeing when that can be added. I also have Mr. Bailey here from our office if there might be any questions that you might seek on how that might interact with our public school system. And I hear that you would like a very short and sweet. So I thank you very much for hearing this bill. Again, this is something that is part of a solution for our Montana children, and I thank the sponsor for bringing this. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Superintendent. And I did also omit to add, please stick around for questions from the committee. And if you do need to leave, we can possibly work in some questions right away, but preferable to just stay in the room. So next proponent.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Thomas Moore, T-O-M, M-O-O-R-E, Superintendent, Great Falls Public Schools. I stand before you this afternoon in support of this bill. I'd like to thank Representative Carlin for bringing this bill. I'd like to share with you quickly some statistics from one of the largest school districts in the state. And this is from the Youth Risk Behavior Survey that we give every other year to students in our middle schools and high schools. And in 2021, 46% of the respondents in our high schools responded feeling depressed for at least 2 weeks throughout their year, so much so that they had contemplated attempting suicide or doing harm to themselves. And 11% of the high school students surveyed during the 21 survey actually reported attempting suicide. Yeah, 34% of our middle school students reported that they felt depressed for at least 2 weeks during that that particular year or 12-month period. 28% reported attempting or contemplating attempting suicide, and 17% reported actually attempting to do so. This last year, and this was from March of through June of 2022, 57 Great Falls Public Schools students presented at the emergency room in Great Falls at Benefice Hospital Healthcare Systems for active or passive suicide ideation. 22 of those students were sixth graders. One student death by suicide in our school district last year during that time frame. From August 24th through the present, 52 students have presented at the ER in Great Falls for active or passive ideation. 15 of those students were sixth graders, and two students have committed suicide in our school district to date this year alone. So I stand before you in favor of this bill because we need a tool in the toolbox to predict and intervene earlier with our students. One of the things about this bill that I appreciate is, again, that it's not a required tool to use, but it is at the disposal of the school district to utilize it. The other piece that's important in this is the communication with parents. When we administer the YRBS, for example, parents are notified in advance of this particular survey, and they can opt out of it if they don't want their students to participate in it. I would assume that we'll follow suit with this particular tool, and we'll notify students, parents in advance of doing the screening, and then if they would like to opt out, allow them that opportunity. And one final note, we will be piloting a research-proven screening tool in two of our sixth grade classrooms this spring in Great Falls, and communicating the results of that with OPI and DPHHS. So I stand before you in support of this bill, and thank you for a due pass on this one.
Thank you, Mr. Moore. Next proponent in the room, please.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I am Amber Malinak, M-A-L-I-N-A-K. I'm the principal and superintendent at Rapple J School. In response and to add on to what Mr. Morris said, he represents one of the largest districts. I represent one of the smallest. And we did some work this fall with the Rural Behavioral Health Institute to do the mental health screening with our students in grades 6 through 12. I can assure you that when the screening was done, our students' privacy was guaranteed through the use of random numbers. Our parents were involved with the ability to choose whether or not their students participated. Of those, 96% of our families chose to have their student participate. And it went well. Our students that needed help were able to get it within the day. And I call that a huge success because of how things were set up and laid out ahead of time. Our numbers are so small in our school. I have 65 students K-12. I can't speak to percentages, and so I won't, because I don't want to violate any kind of
1 minute
of privacy issues. But if we look around this room, you don't know who's dealing with depression. You don't know who's dealing with anxiety. We don't know who's dealing with suicidal ideation. A lot of people keep all that in. Students can do that too. And parents are sometimes very surprised with the results presented by their students. So what we can't see, what's going on the inside, necessarily on the outside. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Ma'am, would you please restate your name and spell it for the record, please?
Yes, Amber, A-M-B-E-R, Malinak, M-A-L-I-N-A-K. And I've been in full support of this bill.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Matt Kuntz. I'm the executive director of NAMI Montana, K-U-N-T-Z. We're a grassroots organization that supports, educates, and advocates for Montanans who live with mental health conditions and their family. And we rise in support of this legislation. I do have a handout from the sponsor that he forgot to give during his opening with your...
Yeah, that can go to the secretary. Thanks.
And
well, actually, you know what? You can just pass it around. It just looks like a one-pager.
Okay. Madam Chair, with your permission, I'd like to go pick up my son, and I want to remind you that I took up a ton of your time yesterday. So,
is there any objection to allowing Mr. Kuntz to go?
No. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Kuntz.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Amy Grimal,
GRMOLJEZ, and I rise today on behalf of the Billings Clinic. The Billings Clinic wholeheartedly supports this bill. We want to thank Representative Carlin for bringing it forward. I don't want to repeat prior testimony, but just wanted to let you know that we serve in a psychiatric capacity for the greatest number of patients on the Billings side east. We have a psychiatric inpatient unit and a youth partial hospitalization program. We work hand in hand with School District 2 in the Billings area and in all of our affiliates. So we think this is a really important bill step forward and want to say thank you for supporting it.
Thank you. Ms. Grimalis, would you please spell your name for the record?
Oh, I apologize. I thought I did. GRMOLJEZ, and the first name is AIMEE. I apologize, Madam Chair.
You might have done it. I just, maybe you were too fast.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Chad Johnson, C-H-A-D-J-O-H-N-S-O-N, representing Hardin School District 17H and 1, which is comprised of almost 1,800 students, 350 staff, over 80% Native American, Crow, and Northern Cheyenne. As you are probably aware, there's been an experience, especially in the last 3 years, of some incredible trauma and tragedy that has not only occurred across the nation, but impacted my community and my school district heavily during that time. And so not to repeat everything, but Superintendent Malinak is absolutely correct. I am currently partnership with RBHI right here. That information is completely secure. The only individuals are aware of what's going on regarding that is the school system. So we do appreciate that work. A proponent of this bill. We did a survey of nearly 800 students this past fall, and we looked at the data, and it did show that approximately 10% of those students, which is what we're seeing across the nation, are reporting some of these suicidalities. So you take those 800 students times 10%, those are 80 of our students that we had high impact in on that day or the following day, as well as many others on our radar that we now watch. And more importantly, what I'm really excited about, thank you for this time, is the fact that we can now collect this data longitudinally, so we can watch students and this information from the moment they take it as a sixth grader all the way through their senior year. And that's extremely important for us to provide opportunities, resources. So thank you for your time. Fully support this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. If proponents can go ahead and stand up before and actually line up, if you want to save some time, I can anticipate questions from the committee. So thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jenny Murnan Butcher, M-U-R-N-A-N-E-B-U-T-C-H-E-R. I am the Deputy Director of Montanans Organized for Education, which is a group of community members and parents that care deeply about our public schools. I also come before you today as a former educator. In my 5 years as a teacher, I experienced the tragedy of losing a former student to suicide. I also supported several students and their families through periods of suicidal ideation. School counselors, teachers, principals, and paraeducators are often tasked with being the first responders to mental health crises for youth. And schools need more support to meet the challenges facing their students. Mental health school screening programs provide counselors, educators, and families with the information they need to be proactive in addressing the real mental health challenges facing children and adolescents today. Additionally, current events have recently shown that mental health is a national crisis, especially in our schools. Montanans Organized for Education thanks the sponsor for bringing this bill and strongly supports the allocation of resources for schools in this time of need and urges a yes vote on HB 252. Thank you.
Thank you. Next proponent.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Tom Livers, L-I-V-E-R-S, Chaudière Children's Hospital. Many of the reasons have already been stated, I won't repeat them, but early intervention is a key before students need more intensive services like we offer. Fully support that, or worse, before they stay under the radar and take action. that can't be reversed. So we are in full support of this bill. Prime criterion for admission to acute inpatient is imminent danger of self-harm, significant self-harm, or harm to others. And it's sadly common. So fully support this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Livers.
Good afternoon. My name is Bella Nyman. That's spelled N-Y-M-A-N. I work for the Rural Behavioral Health Institute, and we are hopeful to implement early intervention. But what I would like to say is that I have struggled with my mental health my whole life, and if it were not for early intervention, I would not be standing here today. So I urge you to think about that and think about the children who do not get early intervention and who do not have a support system and cannot talk to somebody, because that's how we lose lives. So this is very important, and I'm in full support.
Thank you, Ms. Nyman. I'm glad you're here.
Good afternoon, Madam Chairman, or Madam Chair, and members of the committee. My name is Heather Zaluski. Last name is spelled Z-A-L-U-S-K-I. I'm here as a child psychiatrist and as the medical director of the Rural Behavioral Health Institute, and I'm here in full support of House Bill 252 and very grateful to the sponsor. I wanted to say I do stand before you as the medical director and a child psychiatrist in Montana, and also as a mother, as I have a 16-year-old who struggles with depression, anxiety, and suicidal thoughts, as well as a daughter who lost their mother to suicide at age 14. So I'm very passionate about finding solutions to Montana's mental health crisis. I have been practicing in Montana for over 15 years. I spent most of that time at Chaudière Children's Hospital working directly with children in suicide crisis. I left that position last year to join RBHI because I wanted to impact Montana's suicide crisis on a broader level. As much as I loved working one-on-one with my patients, I realized that I wasn't going to move the needle on our terrible suicide statistics in that position, and that this position would give me the capacity to impact things on a much broader level. And I can tell you that our program does exactly that. Universal screening allows us to identify all the children that are struggling, not just the ones that are already on people's radars. And every screening we've done, we've identified at least one child that nobody knew was suffering. And that is very powerful for parents. Data shows that most parents who tragically lose their child to suicide had no idea that their child was struggling. So House Bill 252 would fund broader screening and would allow Montana to move from our current position of being a leader in suicide deaths to being a leader in suicide prevention. This is a momentous opportunity, and I respectfully ask that you support House Bill 252. This bill would definitely save lives. Thank you.
Thank you.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Janet Lindau. I am the Executive Director of the Rural Behavioral Health Institute. I'm also an Associate Professor of Psychiatry, and my expertise is in suicide prevention among youth and digital mental health care. I am standing here in full support of House Bill 252. I would like to reiterate everything that has been stated. Those were real facts. And I'd also like to give you a little bit of background. I co-founded RBHI because I was one of the kids that didn't get identified. I was top of my class, an athlete, had lots of friends. Out from the outside, I looked just fine. I was not okay. And I didn't get help until I was 38 years old because of the stigma related to mental health. I lost a dear partner to suicide, and I lost an uncle to suicide, and I have a niece who struggles with suicide. Most of us, whether we know it or not, have friends and loved ones who are struggling with suicide, potentially, or mental health issues. So it's something that affects all of us. And what I'd like to say is we are not just working to prevent suicide. If you think about the long picture with this, we are supporting students to be as successful as possible. If we can address things that they're struggling with, depression, anxiety right now, and maybe suicidality when they're
12, 13,
14 years old, get them the help they need, they're going to be able to be more successful socially, academically. They have a better chance of graduating high school. They have a better chance of attending college, and they have a higher chance of getting a higher paying job. So we are trying with our program to set students up for success long term. And that is, at the end of the day, I think what we all care about is making sure the children in our state are supported and successful. So thank you. I'm in support of the bill and appreciate the sponsor putting it forward. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Lindau, could you please spell your name for us?
Yes, I'm sorry. It's Janet, J-A-N-E-T, Lindau, L-I-N-D-O-W.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Carlson, members of the committee. I'm Senator Marianne Dunwell. I represent Senate District 42, which is where you're sitting right now, all of you. And so Helena and East Helena. So I'm here today because this is an issue really close to my heart. I'm going to speak personally first. I had a loved one. This was years and years ago. There was this pilot screening program in his middle school, and parents had the option of approving it, and I did. And, you know, I knew... Okay, my son was... moody, and I was trying to discern, is this a typical teen or something going on here? So with the screening, I got an answer. It was identified early on when everybody thought it was just being a typical teen, that he had depression. And his life has turned around, and he's here today.
1 minute.
Thanks to Shodair and all of the wonderful providers, many of whom are represented here. So, like Dr. Lindau said, this is an opportunity for you as legislators, for myself as a legislator, when it gets over to the Senate, I'm thinking positively, to help students' wellness, help them succeed, and help them survive and save lives. What an accomplishment if we can say we did that in the 68th legislative session. Please vote yes. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator. Further proponents in the room? If you are a proponent online, please raise your hand at this time.
Madam Chair, representatives, my name is Kaylee Brown, K-A-Y-L-E-I-G-H. B-R-O-W-N, and I am the Implementation Director for Rural Behavioral Health Institute. I stand before you today in support of this bill. I have spent the last decade working with youth who have had suicidal ideation, depression, and anxiety, and I've seen how early intervention can help them to be successful adults. One of the youth that I worked with is sitting next to me and just spoke to you about her struggles and her survival. I have been able to work with schools since September, screening over 4,000 kids for suicidal ideation, behaviors, depression, and anxiety, and have been able to connect kids to care all over the state. All of the superintendents who spoke, we've worked closely, kept students' information private, and ultimately we've gotten kids to the support that they need, whether that's continued mental health care, if that's family support, or seeing a psychiatrist or mental health professional. So I just wanted to speak that what the school screenings are doing are really getting kids to the support that they ultimately need and getting families the resources that they often don't know about, and breaking down the barriers that families have in getting the kids the full support they need.
Are there any further proponents in the room? We will hear from proponents online, and today, because of the time constraints, if you are a proponent online, we'll have you speak and spell your name and share that you are a proponent, but we do not have time for further testimony for online, but we want to be sure that you have an opportunity to go on the record as a proponent. We'll start with Tobin Navasio.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee. I apologize for not being there in person today. I want to thank you for taking on what I believe is truly the most pressing crisis for Montana families, as my colleagues and friends at the Rural Behavioral Health Institute have explained, and I fully support House Bill 252 and ask that you vote to support it as well. Thank you.
Thank you.
T-O-B-I-N-N-O-V-A-S-I-O.
Thank you. Next, we'll hear from Nicole Gomez.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Nicole Gomez. That's G-O-M-E-Z on behalf of Montana Women Vote. And we would like to express our full support for this bill and ask for a due pass. Thank you.
Thank you. Daniel Martin.
Yeah, hello. Thank you, Madam Chair, and to members of the committee. I rise in support, full support of this bill today. Being from a rural area, Dillon, Montana, and Beaver Head County, with a high suicide and mental health rate, I'm in full support of this, and I urge all of you in the room to vote yes to support rural areas like my own.
Thank you. Mr. Martin, are you here on behalf of yourself today?
I am, yes.
Thank you. Kathleen Wiedemeyer.
Hello. Thank you for letting me speak, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Kathleen Wiedemeyer, K-A-T-H-L-E-E-N-W-E-D-E-M-E-Y-E-R. I'm with the Citizens Commission on Human Rights, a psychiatric watchdog group. We oppose this bill for the following reasons, and I'll be very brief.
Pardon me, Ms. Wiedemeyer. We are hearing from proponents right now.
Oh, okay.
Are there further proponents online who have not spoken? Dr. Wilson.
Hi, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Lauren Wilson, W-I-L-S-O-N. I'm speaking today on behalf of the Montana chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics, representing 160 pediatricians, and also on behalf of the Montana Medical Association, which is the voice for 1,400 physicians in Montana. Both organizations are in strong support of this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Wilson. There's seeing no further proponents in the room or online, are there any opponents in the room? Seeing none, we will go back to Kathleen Wiedemeyer online. And I apologize, Ms. Wiedemeyer, you are signed up correctly. I just wasn't looking closely enough.
Oh, no problem. And I'm going to be very brief here, but I want to apologize for not staying on the line when I testified on HB 17. I did not myself sign up for that. I was unable to sign up online, and that was done for me. And I didn't realize I was signed up as an informational witness. So I didn't know I was supposed to stay on the line, and I greatly apologize. I certainly meant no disrespect to the committee.
Thank you.
Okay, and that being said, I want to say that we are opposed to this bill as written. Our concern is that that it will lead to or could lead to engaging more people in diagnosis and treatment, at the core of which is usually the prescription of one or more drugs, psychotropic drugs. There are over 6 million children in the United States on drugs today, and over a third of them are on antidepressants. And antidepressants are some of the drugs that have the most severe side effects. So we have a concern about that and would ask that it not be passed as drafted, but look at some alternative things involving community leaders, parents, peers, et cetera. Anyway, that I know you didn't really want testimony, so I'm done.
That's okay, Ms. Wiedemeyer. As we did move on to opponents, it seems only fair to let you speak for 2 minutes.
Oh, okay, great. Well, then I will just go ahead and say that we feel that some of this is already being done. We learned that the Rural Behavioral Health Institute has been screening students in a pilot program for the past couple of years and intends to screen 20,000 more this year. The Youth Risk Behavior Survey of 2021 stated that the 22,576 students surveyed constituted 98% of students in grades 7 through 12, so they also have been screened. One of the main questions, like I said, that arises is, will this pilot lead to engaging more people in diagnosis and treatment based on questions on behavior? Treatment which can lead to the administering of one or more psychotropic drugs. And these are drugs that have as possible side effects worsening depression, anxiety, hostility, and aggression, and increased suicidality, with recent studies showing them to be no more effective than a placebo. Our concern also is what is the same-day treatment that is mentioned in the bill.
Ms. Wiedemeyer, if you can stay available, if committee members have questions, we would appreciate that.
Sure.
We will now hear from any informational witnesses in the room.
Good afternoon, Chair Carlson and members of the committee. For the record, Megan Peel, P-E-E-L, and I am the Children's Mental Health Bureau Chief with DPHHS and work with RBHI on a pilot program this year, and happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Peel. Are there further informational witnesses in the room?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Carl Roston, Carl with a K, Roston, R-O-S-S-T-O-N. I'm the suicide prevention coordinator for the department and have been working on this pilot program for the past 2 years with RBHI.
Thank you, Mr. Roston. Are there further informational witnesses? Seeing none, we will go ahead and hear questions from the committee. Representative Staffman.
Thank you. Question for Mr. Roston, please. Madam Chair, Mr. Roston, if you know, can you tell us about what percentage of the youth suicides we experience in Montana are kids who we did not know had a problem that screening particularly would address versus kids who were in some kind of therapy or something like that?
Madam Chair, Representative Staffman, that's difficult because if they don't report it, we don't know about it. But what we can tell, as Dr. Lindau has mentioned, is every time they screen, there's a few kids that show up that did not have any, were not on anybody's radar. They weren't on any, their parents, the school, any type of mental health. And what we know about what's critical about that is that if you have a history of, or if you have symptoms of depression that's untreated, you are 25 times the risk of suicide. And so by identifying these kids and allowing them to get the help that they need, we are greatly reducing the probability of an attempt.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Smith.
Madam Chair, I have a question for Ms. Peel.
Madam Chair, Representative Smith.
So you've had the pilot. have you had the opportunity to get stakeholder feedback, and can you kind of give us a summary, if you have, of what that looks like?
Chair Carlson, Representative Smith. My project is kind of an expansion of a project that Mr. Roston has been working on with the Rural Behavioral Health Institute for a couple of years. So permission to redirect.
Would you like to refer that question?
I would like to refer that question.
Okay.
Madam Chairman, Representative Smith. We have been able to provide grants to this program for the last 2 years. In that time, we've had more than nearly 5,000 students screened, of which approximately 9% came back as being high risk for suicide. That 9%, 100% of those kids received services the same day. Also, 100% of the parents were notified, of course. 17% of those kids indicated a history, lifetime history at some point, of suicidal intent with a plan. Also, it identified at least 10% of these students that had clinical symptoms of both depression and anxiety.
Thank you.
Representative Frazier.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question would be for Mr. Roston. Sorry, you're kind of up and down and up and down. Madam Chair, Mr. Roston, based upon previous statements, do you have any sort of data information on suicidal rates in teens, youth, that can be directly attributed to using psychiatric medications?
Madam Chairman, Representative Frazier, I do not, as far as we, the number, we don't. I don't have any way of knowing how many kids were on medications. I may refer that, though, to either Dr. Zalewski or Dr. Lindau. They may be better able to answer than I can.
If we can refer, Madam Chair.
Dr. Lindau? Dr. Well, you choose. Dr. Zalewski?
Yeah. Good afternoon. So if you wouldn't mind just reframing the question or repeating your inquiry.
Madam Chair, Dr.
Zalewski.
Zalewski, thank you. I'm kind of looking for an idea of, or if it's even as what the opponent stated, if there is any sort of percentage of how many of our youth have committed suicide based on taking psychiatric medications as a negative side effect or something like that. Do you have any data that might back that up?
So I can speak to a couple of things. One is the process of the screening linked to care itself, just to clarify. So when students are screened, they take the suicide screener, the depression screener, the anxiety screener. If they screen at high risk for suicide, they see a mental health professional, typically a therapist or a school counselor, that same day. They are evaluated for safety, and they do a safety plan. That meeting is not a diagnostic evaluation. So students are not diagnosed during that. Families are offered case management, and then case management can reach out to the families, which is a completely free service, ask them if they would like to have a referral to therapy or to see a psychiatric provider. I am available to see the kids that are screened, and I will do a diagnostic evaluation, a comprehensive diagnostic evaluation, and then we'll talk about treatment options. Definitely my first choice for children who are struggling with anxiety and depression is therapy, and unless it is, you know, a matter of complete, you know, urgency or they're completely incapacitated, but we always go the therapy route first. In terms of data regarding kids that complete suicide that are or are not on antidepressants, I think that's beyond the scope of this committee hearing. I would certainly be happy to pull references and forward them to the committee.
Follow-up, Madam Chair.
Follow-up?
If you can explain to the committee, I'm assuming you prescribe psychiatric medications.
Yes, sir.
What process you go through to, if you are prescribing psychiatric medications, mm-hmm. to make sure that those negative side effects don't happen, how are you monitoring that, such as, you know, you'll start off on a lower dose of something that doesn't typically have risks of suicidal ideation? Can you explain that?
Yes, absolutely. Thank you, Representative and Madam Chair. So I would do a comprehensive psychiatric evaluation that would involve getting a lot of, you know, background information from the child, from their family. Then we would sit down typically for an hour or an hour and a half, collect family history, social history, medical history, and talk about functional impairment as well, because I mean, we all struggle at times, right, with depression, anxiety, and other symptoms. That doesn't mean we all carry psychiatric diagnoses. And then I would talk about treatment options. And again, based on the patient's presentation, their preference, their parents' preference, we'll talk about options. We would do informed consent, just like any medical procedure. Talk about risks, benefits. I always start at the lowest possible dose. And I also, in my practice, I follow kids very closely. Like I would follow up with them within a week to ensure that we weren't seeing any negative side effects. And then I transfer the kids to another provider for longer term care so that I can continue to evaluate and see kids at risk. But I'm also available to those providers for consultation if things do start to get worse for that kid instead of better, as we would hope.
All right. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Doctor.
Dr. Zaliski, I have a follow-up, and rather than make you sit down and come back, I just want to follow up on that.
Yeah.
In your timeline in relation to this bill.
Yes.
I'm sensing an assumption that Rural Behavioral Health Initiative, or if I got your name right, is the recipient of this appropriation. But if I'm wrong, the question still stands.
Okay.
The screening takes place
yes.
at the school.
Yes.
If there's a need, mm-hmm. an observed need, this student would see most likely a school counselor.
Yes, or we do offer, and just to be clear, we are the current vendor, but this bill doesn't appropriate the money okay. to us. We would apply.
I'm more interested in the timeline.
Okay, sure.
Then the family would see this, or the student would see most likely a school counselor or something equivalent, mm-hmm. and then the family would be brought in for what you, I think you said case management or something like that. And then at that time, whoever the vendor is, let's just say, that person evaluates the child as a medical provider, and is that service billable, and is that what the cost of the bill is going towards? Is that evaluation? I just want to make sure we're on the bill.
Sure. So just to go through the process, because I know there are several steps. So the child takes a screening. If they screen at high risk for suicide, they're evaluated the same day, either by school-based therapists, or we also do contract with private licensed therapists that can see the child via telehealth, which is very helpful in some of our rural communities and smaller schools where they have very limited resources. Then that information is communicated back to the family that day. And again, that is not a diagnostic evaluation, that is assessing the child's safety and doing a comprehensive safety plan with them, and then determining what the next steps might be for that child. Like, yeah, are they already in therapy and they just need to continue with their therapist? If the family is interested, we offer free case management, and that service is not billable, and so the money appropriated in this bill would go to help pay for that service. A case manager is somebody who has typically undergraduate training in a health-related field, and they interact with the family, determine what needs they have, including, I mean, it could be mental health, but it could also be food insecurity or housing, and then they connect them with resources. And then one resource, potentially, that they could be connected with would be to see a psychiatric provider like me through RBHI. And yes, that is a billable service. That is not something that we're asking for money for under this appropriation. We would use private insurance or public insurance, whatever the child had, to bill for that service.
Thank you for walking us through that. I appreciate that. It looks like Representative Zephyr.
Madam Chair, for Ms. Zaliski.
Yeah.
Madam Chair, Ms. Zaliski, you're talking about resources for counselors in this area.
Yes.
I'm curious, in relation to the appropriations for this, I know there are programs across the MUS system, like the Rural Mental Health Preparation Pathway through UM that tries to use federal funding to steer mental health counselors towards rural areas. Mm-hmm. Is this something where appropriations from this could be used to expand upon that, or is that something separately completely?
I apologize, but I don't have expertise in that area. I don't know if anybody else would be able to answer that.
Okay. Looks like I have work for myself cut out after this committee. Follow-up for Mr. Rostin.
Okay, Dr. Lindau might be able to better. May I redirect?
May I re-refer?
We can refer that to Dr. Lindau.
So I don't think I have precise information, but what is critical for us to support all these kids is to build a network of therapists across our state. So they would be in a referral network that we could then direct students to that wouldn't be paid for off of this bill, but that would be a place. So say we identify 10% of kids and they are going to need maybe longer-term therapy. They may or may not need a psychiatrist like Dr. Zaliski. They may just need, you know, a licensed LCSW, so a social worker. And so if they have a chain where they can be providing those social workers, those would be people that could then treat children that are identified. So it would be bringing up the mental health workforce concurrently with what we're doing. Did that answer your question? Kind of,
yes. Thank you. Follow-up for Mr. Rostin.
One last follow-up, and then we're going to take Representative Sheldon Galloway.
Thank you. Madam Chair, Mr. Rostin, thinking about, like, you know, the way reactive versus proactive, and this seems like doing a really good job at getting ahead of identifying children who would be having mental health crises before they become mental health tragedies. Mm-hmm. I wanted to ask briefly about new section 1, section 2E, where it says reports to the department on the number of students screened in a de-identified manner. Does that de-identified manner collect any demographic data? I think specifically, are we going to have, as we look to make sure this is something that, you know, we're not saying, okay, this is our sixth graders who are having trouble, these are our seventh graders, but can we identify across demographic intersections? It's our young girls. There's an intersection of race or sexuality. Are we able to identify that through this de-identified
data? Madam Chairman and Representative Zephyr, the department doesn't receive any identifying information at all about any of the participants. It's a generated number that then is mostly shared between, and I would probably refer to Dr. Zalewski or Dr. Lindau because they're running it, but my understanding is that it's a program, it's a number that helps identify the student with the school so that if a student scores high, that they can be immediately identified or presented to the school for the immediate services. As far as any demographics, I would refer to probably Dr. Lindau because she'd be better able to do this.
May we refer that?
Yes, I think it's valuable information.
Thank you.
Go ahead and do that.
Yes, so we're very careful with any data sharing that could be potentially identifiable. So some schools are willing to provide grade level with like the grade that's being screened. So what we can break data down is by county and by school type, so middle school or high school. So we could break it, at least we would know if it's the younger kids versus the older children that are in the with the data, the suicidality data that we're collecting. But that right now, because of, you know, privacy and so forth, we are not collecting any more, nothing on gender, nothing on race. So unfortunately, that's not something we can provide right now. And that is something that's been really important to schools. And we want to be respectful of protecting students.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Sheldon Galloway is going to get the last question here. Well, actually, before I say that, how many questions do we have left? Oh, I apologize. I did not see the two of you. Okay, we'll have these three questions, and then we'll finish up. Vice Chair Sheldon Galloway.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't know who could answer this, so maybe someone could raise their hand. Ask the sponsor. There we go, and he can decide. And maybe you can answer that, Madam Chair, Representative Carlin. Are parents able to know exactly how the screening happens with questions and the process before they just sign a paper saying that they want their children? Because I want to try to clear that up for parents that might be hesitant on that. It's not that they don't want their child not to know, but they might be hesitant saying the school is overstepping their bounds. Could you help us understand that process?
Madam Chair, Vice Chair Sheldon Galloway, yes, I... Can I re-refer to that, please?
Yes, you may. Oh, sorry.
You certainly may. Thank you.
information ahead of time, and they are able to contact us to ask any questions about what the screening looks like. They're also given results from the screening if they request it, and they are given results of what a therapist and their child talked about. So parents are really a big part of the process. And also RBHI currently can call parents with permission and talk about any questions that they have regarding the screening or what was talked about with their child.
I have two tiny questions.
Follow up?
Thank you. Please stay there. So How often is it given, or is it given on a date and then all of a sudden, I guess what I want to protect is the stigma with kids. It's like, you know, we were tested today and, oh, so-and-so just left the classroom, and help with that stigma side. How is that protected for kids?
Yeah, so all students are able to be on a computer at the same time because it is digital mental health screening. And so no one can tell who is taking the screener and who is not if a parent chose to opt out or if a child chooses to not take the screener. And then schools work with their teachers to find ways to take students out of the classroom to make sure that it's not that identifiable. So it might be getting them in the hallway between classes. Every school is a little unique. Some schools have said, we're going to sign up for after-school programming, so I'm going to take every student out and talk to them. Some schools have met with every single student that they've screened just to see how the screening made them feel, but we really try to work so kids aren't feeling excluded.
Representative Safman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a quick question for Dr. Lindo, please, and it's along the same lines as the last question. Could you sum up for us briefly the kind of reaction that you've received from rural parents in particular to this process, and do they like it? Does it work? Thanks.
Sure. Thank, Madam Chair and Representative Staffman. I would say 99% of the feedback we get, Kaylee is the one who actually knows, hears all this directly, is positive. We get a lot of thank yous from parents saying, I had no idea my child was suffering. And they have also been really happy that we can direct them towards resources. So one thing to keep in mind is often when a child is struggling, the family may be struggling too. And so if parents, it's very hard for them to call four or five different therapists trying to find somewhere they can get their kid in less than 3 to 6 months. And so we're trying to break down barriers, and we've heard a lot of really positive feedback on how helpful that was. So I would say, in general, we're hearing very positive feedback, especially from people living in rural parts of our state.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Marshall.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Rostin, please. Madam Chair, Mr. Rostin, this has been going on for quite some time, obviously, with this pilot program and everything that you've had. Over the years, I won't date myself, but for quite a few years, this has been ongoing with, I mean, youth depression, suicide has been getting worse and worse and worse. Is there anything that you guys have come collectively to a consensus root causes? What's the problem? I'm looking at the now. I'm going to go back to where, what's the start point of this stuff? What's going on with our youth? Why the buildup with all this?
Madam Chairman, Representative Marshall, that's a loaded question. There are a number of factors. What we know that the issues nationally, the issues of suicide and depression and anxiety are getting worse. As a matter of fact, worldwide, what we know, what we're hearing from the World Health Organization is by 2030, depression is going to be the number one health issue in the world. That's 7 years from now. So there's a lot of theories. I've heard that we're basically diluting the gene pool in some ways, in that we're passing it down. It's a genetic. There's a strong genetic predisposition. We have a number of social factors. If you take a look at the factors, even in Montana and the Rocky Mountain region around suicide, it's not that we have one or two issues. It's that we have multiple factors, and in the Rocky Mountain region, we have a perfect storm as far as all these things happening at the same time. And so issues of socioeconomic, we have issues of lack of behavioral health. Stigma is huge. We have high-risk populations. We have vitamin D deficiencies. We have alcohol use. We have access to lethal means. There's a whole gamut of factors that are all contributing, and they're getting worse. Why they're getting worse, I think that's really hard to tell. I can tell you, as along with being in my position as the suicide prevention coordinator, I've also been a therapist for 30 years. The majority of the time has been working with children. And unfortunately, what I'm seeing is I'm seeing a growing generation of kids that have no ability to deal with adversity. They don't have coping skills. They don't have resiliency. And there's a number of factors that could play into that. But I just know that it seems like kids are getting younger and younger and not being able to deal with things and need the resources.
Thank you, committee. I have one question for Ms. Peel, please, before we close.
Chair Carlson.
Thank you, Ms. Peel, for being here today. And I want to know, first of all, I'm just going to make an observation that can be answered at a later time. I'm not seeing any provision in this bill for parental consent for this program. It's not here, and we're putting a program in the law that I have two questions. One is, you are involved in a pilot project of this type right now with no code. So do you need this to be passed into law to do the program, or do you need it to be this bill to pass so that you get the appropriation?
Thank you for the question, Chair Carlson. We currently are running this pilot project funded with some COVID relief funding called the Governor's Education or Emergency Education Relief Funds. And so that we have, we initially had 1 year of funding, and just recently the governor's office committed to giving us an extension of another year of funding. And so we do have the authority. We don't need legislation to do the program, but that funding will run out.
Okay, and my last question is, I think we've talked about this. I'm concerned about the amount of surveys and testing and data that's coming from our kids at school. Is this going to, in some way, replace the youth risk behavior survey? Because are we just adding another universal thing at school to have our kids do?
Yeah, thank you for that question, Chair Carlson. I don't know if you want me to reply to the consent piece about what our program currently does. If you do, no, okay. No. The youth risk behavior screener, I think Dr. Lindau could talk in more detail if you want it, but it isn't an evidence-based screener. It's but the screeners that they are using for the screening linked to care are evidence-based actual mental health screeners rather than a survey.
I think I got it.
Okay.
Thank you, Ms. Peel. Representative, would you like to close on your bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I know it's been a long afternoon, and I really appreciate the thorough hearing. I won't reiterate what I said in my opening, but I really do believe that this is a unique opportunity to make Montana a leader in mental health and to try to reverse some of these really tragic statistics that I think are a black mark on our state when it comes to youth suicide risk. Regarding parental consent, I am more than happy to work with Madam Chair and the committee to more clearly flesh that out. I mean, currently nothing happens without parental consent in this program. And that's, frankly, for me, a non-starter. I don't believe we should be doing anything without parental consent. And so if we need to clarify what the current policy is, I'm more than happy to work with an amendment on that. We also, in the bill, and again, we can even make this more clear, want to make it clear that this is only for schools that choose to participate. No school would be participating in this unless they choose to. And if schools don't feel that they need this program, they don't have to participate. And likewise with parents. Parents will be notified, and if they don't want to participate, that's completely fine. I've been, as the superintendent of public instruction mentioned, we are actively working on some language to even further strengthen student data privacy on both legislative staff agree that data privacy is protected in this bill. We have HIPAA, we have FERPA, but we're working on language to even further strengthen that. That would make OPI more comfortable, and that's something that today we're working on. The last thing I want to add is just touch on the appropriation in this bill. The money right now comes from HART Fund, so from marijuana tax dollars. And, you know, this is something that I am should this committee and the floor choose to advance this policy, I'm excited to work with the Appropriations Committee on and finding the best sources of funding for this program. We believe that HART funds are a good source for this, but we're, again, certainly open and excited to discuss if there are other ideas on funding and reimbursement rates and things like that. So to close, I'll just add, I think that we're at a really pivotal point right now when it comes to youth mental health care. And this is a chance to make sure that, you know, as we've heard from all the witnesses, this is a program that's currently operating and it's remarkably successful, but too many students in the state don't have access to this program. And I think we're not going to really be able to see the benefit to the entire state unless every school is able to participate. And that's what this bill will do. It'll make sure that rural and urban, every school, every student, we're able to make sure that they're connected with the resources that they need and build that network of mental health professionals that, you know, unfortunately, we're going to, as we've heard, really need to rely on in the coming years and decades. So thank you again for the thorough hearing.
Thank you, Representative Carlin. We only have thorough hearings in this committee. Thank you, everyone who participated today. And this ends the hearing on House Bill 252. Members, I would remind you that I believe there is a dinner in the rotunda, and we will see you tomorrow for two bills and 6 to 8 executive actions. Oh, and members, there were amendments when you sat down, so make sure you grab those if you want to look at them in advance.